program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Hello and welcome to Audio Journal's look at history from all points of the globe, a program that reports on what has happened so we might consequently find out what could happen. Material is selected with the interests of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. I'm Tricia Droney, and today, for the next hour, we'll explore a variety of topics, including the history of driverless cars, also the history of the red carpet. Why do we roll out the red carpet? As well as learning about plunging to the depths of the ocean. We'll begin with an article by Dave Roos of History.com entitled The Surprisingly Long History of Driverless Cars. It was published March 20th, 2026. As fleets of driverless taxis fan out in cities across the United States and new cars come with an array of autonomous features, it might be surprising to learn that the self-driving car has been in the works for more than a century. Here are some landmark moments in the evolution of driverless cars. 1925, radio-controlled wonder. On July 27, 1925, a former U.S. Army engineer named Francis Houdina wowed spectators in New York City with his American wonder, one of the world's first driverless cars. Every part of the specially equipped Chandler sedan was controlled remotely by radio, throttle, brakes, steering wheel, even the horn. As the ghost car made its way down Broadway, Houdina and the car's operators followed close behind. Then everything went haywire. The radio controls malfunctioned, and the Chandler started careening wildly down the street. At 47th Street, Houdina lunged for the steering wheel, but could not prevent the car from crashing into the fender of an automobile filled with cameramen, the New York Times reported. It was at 43rd Street that a crash into a fire engine was barely averted. Anthony Towson, a researcher at Cornell Tech's Urban Tech Hub, can't help but see similarities between the 1925 failure of the American Wonder and the high-profile malfunctions that still plague driverless cars today. It's a pattern that was established a long time ago with these things, says Townsend, author of Ghost Road, Beyond the Driverless Car. They're going to have bugs and breakdowns just like any other technology. 1957, the Highway of the Future. At the 1939 World's Fair in New York, General Motors displayed its captivating Futurama exhibition showing self-driving cars zipping along a traffic-free highway of the future. In 20 years, GM predicted that cars on the highway would be controlled by electromagnetic guide wires embedded in the pavement. The idea captured America's imagination, and by the late 1950s, engineers at the Radio Corporation of America, RCA, were on track to make it a reality. You reach over to your dashboard and push the button marked electronic drive, read an article in Electronic Age, RCA's quarterly magazine. Selecting your lane, you settle back to enjoy the ride as your car adjusts itself to the prescribed speed. You may prefer to read or carry on a conversation with your passengers or even to catch up on your office work. On October 10, 1957, the idea was put to the test on a 400-foot strip of highway outside Lincoln, Nebraska. RCA embedded the roadway with electrified guide wires that sent signals to coils on the bumper of a specially wired Chevrolet. The car steered and accelerated without a hitch. The Nebraska test was a breakthrough in driverless technology, and U.S. highway officials were intrigued. There was only one problem, the cost. A study was done looking at the projected cost of the new interstate highway system and what it would cost to add this technology to it. And it would basically add 40 to 50% of the construction to the construction costs, so it was never seriously considered, Townsend said. 1969, Shaky, the first autonomous vehicle. Shaky the robot, created by a team of artificial intelligence pioneers at Stanford Research Institute in the 1960s, has been called the great-grandfather of self-driving cars because it was the first robot equipped with computers, cameras, and sensors, and programmed with early AI software to move through the world autonomously. Shaky was the first autonomous vehicle in the sense that once it had a destination, it could plan its route to that destination and move itself there, Townsend says. Armed with a TV camera, an optical range finder, and bump detectors, Shaky could map its laboratory environment in real time and respond autonomously to different scenarios and obstacles. Today's self-driving cars are advanced extensions of Shaky's decades-old sensor and machine learning technology. 1987, Ernst Dickmann's self-driving van. The first working prototypes of fully autonomous self-driving cars were built outside of the United States. In 1977, researchers at the Tsuga Mechanical Engineering Lab in Japan built a car that could read painted white lines on streets and cruise autonomously at 20 miles per hour. But the real breakthrough happened in Germany in the 1980s, where an aerospace engineer named Ernst Dickmann took a self-driving Mercedes-Benz van out for a spin on the Autobahn at nearly 55 miles per hour. Dickmann and his colleagues at the Université de Bundeswehr in Munich built an advanced computer guidance system using the latest cameras, sensors, and machine learning algorithms. The news of the autonomous Mercedes van caught the attention of Daimler-Benz, which funded Dickmann's continued experiments with driverless technology. In October 1994, two self-driving Mercedes sedans successfully navigated a Parisian highway without a single human intervention. A year later, another car drove autonomously from Germany to Denmark, covering more than 1,050 miles at speeds of up to 111 miles per hour. Daimler later lost interest and cut funding, but Dickmann is widely considered the father of the modern self-driving car. Next, 1995, cross-country trip in a self-driving car. In the U.S., researchers at Carnegie Mellon University were some of the first to experiment with fully autonomous vehicles. In 1989, the CMU team road-tested the ALVIN, short for Autonomous Land Vehicle in a Neural Network, in a converted Army ambulance. But its most ambitious effort came in the 1990s with a project called No Hands Across America, the first attempt to navigate a self-driving car all the way across the United States. In July 1995, two members of CMU's Robotics Institute took a modified Pontiac Transport on a 2,850-mile road trip from Pittsburgh to San Diego. More than 98% of the record-breaking drive was fully autonomous. Then in 2004, the $1 million DARPA challenge. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, is the research and development branch of the U.S. military. Created in 1958, DARPA funded some of the earliest research that became the Internet. And in the 2000s, it tried to spur the development of autonomous vehicles in America with $1 million in prize money. The Pentagon basically said, we want to see who can build a fully self-driving vehicle, and we're going to set up some tests and give out some prize money, Townsend explains. And all the groups that had been working on this in the 90s, various labs, various companies, all came into that competition. In 2004, the first DARPA Grand Challenge attracted 15 teams attempting to race a self-driving vehicle across a demanding 142-mile course through the Mojave Desert. Not a single entrant finished the race or made it further than 8 miles, so DARPA doubled the prize money in 2005. The winner of the second DARPA challenge was Stanley, a modified Volkswagen SUV built by a Stanford University research team under the leadership of computer scientist Sebastian Thrun and several industry partners. 2015, first self-driving taxi ride. No one really knew it at the time, but Google was sniffing around for folks at the DARPA Challenge to run the team that became the Google Self-Driving Car Project, Townsend said. That's where they found Sebastian Thrun. In 2010, a journalist at the New York Times discovered the existence of Google's secret project to develop a fleet of self-driving taxis. Over the next few years, Google engineers used modified Priuses and Lexus SUVs to test their cameras and AI software on the busy streets of San Francisco and Los Angeles, as well as highways. Then, in 2014, Google unveiled the Firefly, a fully autonomous vehicle without a steering wheel or gas and brake pedals, just two passenger seats. Firefly transported its first passenger on public roads in Austin, Texas in 2015, before heading to retirement 2 years later. A year later, Google spun off its self-driving car division as Waymo, a driverless taxi company now operating in multiple U.S. cities. Next, we have an article written March 23, 2026 by Tom Metcalf entitled, "The 19th Century Discovery Hailed as a Missing Link Between Apes and Humans." In 1891, fossilized bones recovered on the Indonesian island of Java revealed an intriguing, long-sought missing link between humans and apes. The remains, which became known as Java Man, suggested the appearance of a thick-boned being with a flat skull, low forehead, heavy brow ridges, and a femur that indicated it stood and walked upright. They belonged to something human-like, but also not quite human. The find by paleontologist Eugene Dubois electrified the scientific community. By the late 19th century, it was evident to scientists that humans had evolved from other primates, but no fossils had yet been found to support this idea. The remains of the Neanderthals had been discovered, but they were clearly close to modern humans, and the only other primate-like fossils that had been found were gibbon-like creatures. The Java Man fossils, a skull cap and a thigh bone, unearthed near the village of Trinil and the Solo River, were hailed as the first of what Dubois called a human-like transitional form. He named the newfound species Pathecanopropus erectus, which is Latin for upright ape man. The remains were reclassified in the 1950s as an even closer human ancestor named Homo erectus, upright man. Scientists have since discovered an entire family tree of dozens of missing links that evolved from ape-like creatures into modern humans over roughly 7 million years, mainly in Africa. And yet, Homo erectus, Java Man, remains a crucial species in the story of human evolution. A tremendous amount of focus has been placed on Africa over the past few decades, with models emphasizing out-of-Africa scenarios, where modern humans evolved in Africa and then migrated to other continents starting some 80,000 years ago, says paleanthropologist Michael Petriglia of Australia's Griffith University. This model tended to diminish interest in the evolutionary history of Asia. However, recent discoveries in China are indicating that Asia was an active player in the human story. A February 2026 study by Petriglia and his colleagues reviewed recent discoveries in China that indicate a greater diversity of human ancestors than previously expected over the past 2 million years. They include Homo erectus, which is now thought to have entered Asia up to 1.8 million years ago and lived there until about 100,000 years ago. The discoveries also indicated the out-of-Africa wave of modern humans, Homo sapiens, interbred at times with archaic human ancestors beyond Africa. The interbreeding of Homo sapiens with other species of hominins in Asia remains a central question, Petroglia says. However, this interbreeding was likely limited to certain times and places. Calculations later suggested that Dubois had the timeline of Java Man quite wrong. He thought the fossils dated to between 7 and 10 million years ago, during the Pliocene epoch, when theories suggested that humans and apes had diverged. It's now thought that Java Man fossils are up to a million years old, while other Homo erectus fossils found nearby are up to 1.66 million years old. This places them early in the period when Homo erectus is thought to have lived in Southeast Asia. Recent research has further refined the timeline for Homo erectus in Asia, with a new study indicating its oldest fossils in China, the young Xian skulls, date to about 1.77 million years ago. Because of issues with context, with the sites in Indonesia, the age of the Homo erectus fossils, there have never really been clear, explains paleoanthropologist Christopher Bay of the University of Hawaii at Manoa. In China, this has been less of an issue. The Homo erectus fossils, first discovered by Dubois as Java Man more than a century ago, are now revealed as relics from an important phase of human evolution. Their fossils and the fossils of archaic humans that were closely related have also been found throughout Africa, Asia, and Europe, and scientists now think Homo erectus was one of the first human ancestors to control fire, although they probably could not make fire. Archaeological research is showing far more innovations over the last 2 million years than previously recognized, Petroglia says. Recent discoveries indicate that large-brained human ancestors like erectus in Asia were more flexible in their adaptations than scientists once thought, he says. In this way, the original Java Man discovery by Dubois continues to shape scientific understanding of the mosaic of human evolution. Meanwhile, the fossils themselves have been returned to their place of origin. In 2025, the Java Man remains were repatriated from the Netherlands to Indonesia, more than 130 years after their discovery. The ancient skeleton is just one of 28,000 fossils unearthed by Dubois in Indonesia between 1895 to 1920 that the Dutch government has pledged to return to their home country. Dave Roos is the author of our next History.com article entitled "The Man Who Plunged to Record Ocean Depths," published in April of 2026. On June 6, 2012, free diver Herbert Nitsch slipped into the azure waters off the coast of Santorini, Greece, attempting to break his own world record for the deepest a human could travel underwater on a single breath. The sport is called no-limit freediving. There are 10 sanctioned disciplines of freediving, including dynamic with fins, how far you can swim in a pool while holding your breath, and constant weight, swimming as deep as you can and returning to the surface while carrying a weight. But no limit is the most extreme. In no limit, the freediver rides a weighted sled that descends on a rope hundreds of feet below, exposing the body to crushing pressure and extreme cold. Minutes later, the sled buoys the diver safely back to the surface if everything goes right. Because of the extreme physiological toll of deep waters diving, it's common for free divers to black out during or after a dive. Competition rules state that participants must remain conscious for a certain amount of time to qualify for a record. It's also tragically common for free divers to die doing the sport they love. Audrey Mester, Natalie Molchavona, and Loic Laferme are just some of the freediving greats who lost their lives in the water. In 2007, Nitsch descended to 702 feet on his custom-designed sled, setting a new world record and earning him the title of the deepest man on earth. But Nietzsche had greater ambitions. He wanted to break the 1,000-foot barrier. To get there, he planned to stage increasingly deep dives past 800 feet, 900 feet, and finally 1,000. In Santorini in 2012, Nietzsche successfully descended to 830 feet, a new world record that still stands today, but he nearly lost everything in the process. Herbert Nietzsche stumbled into freediving by accident. He was a professional pilot for decades and loved to travel. On a scuba diving trip to Egypt, his equipment was lost in transit, so he decided to spend the week snorkeling. Nietzsche borrowed an underwater camera and spent hours taking photos of the stunning sea life. Distracted by the scenery, Nietzsche would stay submerged for minutes at a time. When he surfaced from one of his dives, a scuba diver friend asked Nietzsche how long he'd been freediving. Nietzsche had never even heard of freediving. He was just snorkeling. Nietzsche borrowed his friend's diving gauge and decided to see how deep he could go on one breath. On his first attempt, Nietzsche descended 105 feet. Not bad, he thought. A few weeks later, this same guy called me and said, "Do you know the Austrian freediving record is only 2 meters deep?" says Nietzsche, who is Austrian. He said, "Buy yourself some decent fins and set a new record." And more or less, that's what he did. Nietzsche was officially hooked on freediving. His pilot job didn't give him much free time to train, but Nietzsche was amazed at how much longer he could hold his breath just by calming his mind and letting his body access the stores of oxygen naturally present in the lungs and bloodstream. The dive reflex happens automatically. You just have to allow it to happen, says Nietzsche, who also set a freediving world record in the static apnea discipline, in which divers hold their breath for as long as possible in a pool. Nietzsche's record was 9 minutes, 4 seconds. You learn that it would be good to breathe again, but you don't have to. While freediving has been practiced for centuries by traditional sponge divers and spearfishers who made their livelihoods by holding their breath underwater, it's relatively new as a competitive sport. The main governing body of freediving, the International Association for the Development of Apnea, also AIDA, A-I-D-A, was founded in 1992. Since freediving is such a new discipline, competitors developed their own techniques and training methods. As a pilot, Nietzsche said he couldn't train as much as others, but he could train smarter. For example, instead of making a series of increasingly deep training dives to improve his lung capacity, he would dive 60 feet and perform static hangs on fully exhaled lungs, allowing them to deflate fully to mimic the high-pressure conditions that cause blood to shift from the extremities to the core and brain. At home between flights, Nietzsche even performed what he called couch training, doing a series of deep and long exhales and breath holds on the couch while watching American sitcoms. When an army friend let Nietzsche borrow his monofin, a single fin that connects both feet and allows a diver to swim like a dolphin, he decided to try it in competition for freediving disciplines like constant weight. At first, people were laughing their heads off because here comes the Austrian who thinks he knows better, says Nietzsche. But after shattering their records, they thought maybe there's something to it. Now there are separate freediving categories for monofins, bifins, and no fins. With his unconventional training methods and equipment hacks, Nietzsche set record after record across multiple freediving disciplines, but there was one competition that spooked him, No Limit. First of all, I thought I couldn't go that deep, and second of all, it's very technical and dangerous, says Nietzsche. No Limit has claimed so many lives that AIDA stopped sanctioning the sport. When Nietzsche finally felt ready to attempt No Limit, he was determined to do it his way, applying the same out-of-the-box thinking and determination to push the limits of human endurance. The most popular freediving discipline is constant weight, in which divers descend and ascend on their own power using a monofin, bifins, or no fins at all. Alexei Molchanov, the star Russian freediver, holds the world records in both constant weight, 446 feet, and constant weight with bifins, 417 feet. Peter Klovar from Croatia holds the record for the deepest constant weight dive without fins, 338 feet. The biggest difference between no limit and most other freediving disciplines is the use of a sled. Instead of descending on their own power, no limit freedivers ride a weighted sled feet first down a long rope. Once the freediver reaches their target depth, they inflate an airbag on the sled using a scuba tank. The buoyancy device then lifts the diver back up the rope to the surface at speeds exceeding 10 feet per second. The speed of both the descent and the ascent is key to making a successful deep low-limit dive. The longer a freediver is below 300 feet, the more nitrogen and other gases are absorbed by the bloodstream and body tissues. When a diver passes 600 feet, the pressure is so great that the lungs are squeezed to the size of limits. No limit freedivers try to limit their exposure to those extreme conditions by descending and ascending as quickly as possible, but not too quickly. The greatest threat to a no-limit freediver is decompression sickness, also known as the bends. When a freediver ascends towards the surface, the water pressure lowers dramatically. If the pressure falls too quickly, it causes the nitrogen absorbed by the body to come out of solution, forming tiny bubbles that can travel to the brain and trigger life-threatening strokes. It's like opening a bottle of champagne too quickly. The bubbles spread everywhere, says Nietzsche. That's more or less what happens inside the body. To prevent that from happening, you need to open the champagne bottle slowly. In freediving, that means slowing your ascent or making a safety stop to release the nitrogen safely. To chase the world record, Nietzsche designed his own no-limit sleds to maximize his speed on both descent and ascent. But one of the remaining challenges of descending so quickly was equalizing sinus and inner ear pressure while descending so fast. To overcome this, Nietzsche devised a simple trick using an empty plastic soda bottle with holes at its bottom and a straw-like tube on the top. At the start of his descent, the bottle is filled with water, and Nietzsche exhales air from his lungs into the soda bottle. Then, as he goes deeper, Nietzsche inhales small sips of air from the bottle and uses them to equalize the pressure in his sinuses and ears. From 2005 to 2007, Nietzsche improved his sled design and soda bottle technique to push progressively deeper, setting and breaking his own no-limit world record again and again. Then, on April 11, 2007, the French freediver Loic Laferme died while training to break Nietzsche's world record, but that did not stop Nietzsche from continuing to push the envelope. 2 months later, Nietzsche rode his sled to a depth of 702 feet, the last no-limit world record sanctioned by ADA. It was the dive that earned him the title of the deepest man on Earth. But Nietzsche wasn't done. 5 years after his record no-limit dive of 702 feet, Nietzsche was ready to push the sport of freediving to new extremes. His goal was 1,000 feet, unimaginable even a few years earlier, but something that Nietzsche believed was achievable with the right equipment, the right team, and the right mindset. His first step was to make a no-limit dive beyond 800 feet, which required a completely redesigned sled. Gone were the inflatable lift bags, which Nietzsche felt were unreliable. In their place, he installed a solid carbon dome and two scuba tanks that released jets of compressed air that rocketed the sled to the surface. To avoid decompression sickness, Nietzsche planned a long decompression stop at 60 feet below the surface to slowly release the nitrogen from his blood. Nietzsche and his safety team trained and prepared for years for all possible contingencies. On June 6, 2012, Nietzsche donned his wetsuit and fluid goggles and rode his space-age sled to a record-breaking depth of 830 feet. Nietzsche activated the compressed air, which sent him and his sled racing toward the surface in a stream of air bubbles. Everything went according to plan on that record-setting day in 2012, until Nietzsche reached his 60-foot decompression stop. To his team of safety divers, it looked like Nietzsche had blacked out. Nietzsche floated limply away from his sled, and his crew panicked. If they didn't get Nietzsche to the surface quickly, he was going to drown. The reality, however, was even stranger. Nietzsche had fallen asleep. Free divers who travel to extreme depths experience nitrogen narcosis, an overload of nitrogen in the bloodstream that makes them feel drunk. The deeper you go, the stronger the narcosis is, says Nietzsche, who was not only drunk on nitrogen, but in a deep meditative state to lower his heart rate and limit oxygen consumption. So this combination of being drunk, relaxed, and really tired caused me to fall asleep. Believing that Nietzsche's life was at risk, the safety team started bringing him to the surface. Nietzsche woke up and immediately realized the danger he was in by failing to properly decompress. He tried to stop ascending, but because his goggles had slid off his nose, he could not locate the dive rope properly. Once at the surface, he grabbed an oxygen tank and swam back down to 60 feet in hopes of somehow staving off decompression sickness. But within minutes, Nietzsche started to feel the effects: numbness, pins and needles, confusion. It was too late. The nitrogen bubbles traveled to Nietzsche's brain, causing a series of small strokes that rendered him unresponsive. Nietzsche was flown to an Athens hospital with a hyperbaric chamber, where he spent the next week in a coma as doctors desperately tried to reverse the crippling effects of nitrogen poisoning. When Nietzsche woke up at a trauma hospital in Germany, he was unable to walk and barely able to speak. His doctors initially thought that he would spend the rest of his life in a wheelchair and suffer permanent cognitive impairment from the strokes. Against the advice of doctors and his family, Nietzsche left the hospital and quit taking medication. Nietzsche battled for many months to regain his short-term memory and recover the ability to walk unassisted and speak fluently. After 2 years, Nietzsche was able to get back into the water, not as a competitive freediver, but simply to enjoy the unmediated connection between humans and the underwater world that freediving offers. Maybe I dive a little deeper than other people, but it's just for fun, says Nietzsche. Nietzsche's 830-foot no-limit dive remains the deepest dive ever. Since ADA stopped sanctioning no-limit dives, Nietzsche's near-death achievement was confirmed by Guinness World Records. In his freediving career, Nietzsche set a total of 33 world records across 9 disciplines. Kelly Marie Kordocki wrote this next article, published in April of 2026, entitled, "This 1960s chatbot was a precursor to AI. Its maker grew to fear it." In 1966, computer scientist Joseph Weizenbaum built a primitive computer program he named Eliza. Almost immediately, he regretted his creation. Developed to mimic psychotherapy exchanges, Eliza sparked unexpectedly deep reactions. Users opened up, shared intimate details about themselves, and treated the program as if it were human. The response was so intense that even Weizenbaum's secretary at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, reportedly asked him to step out so she could speak with the program in private. Eliza is widely recognized as the world's first chatbot, and a version of it is still available online today. Its creation made Weizenbaum a pioneer of artificial intelligence and language processing models, programs designed to analyze and generate responses by recognizing patterns in text. What I had not realized is that extremely short exposures to a relatively simple computer program could induce powerful delusional thinking in quite normal people, Weizenbaum recalled in his 1976 book, Computer Power and Human Reason. This phenomenon, which became known as the Eliza effect, deeply disturbed him. Until his death in 2008, he devoted his life to being one of the technology's fiercest and most vocal critics. The world's first chatbot was never intended to push the limits of artificial intelligence. Weizenbaum designed Eliza more as a psychological experiment than a technological one, explains Brian Merchant, author of Blood in the Machine, The Origins of the Rebellion Against Big Tech. He was interested in how humans interact with machines, and he designed Eliza as a means of investigating that relationship. Eliza worked by scanning a user's typed input for keywords and generating responses that resembled human conversation based on pattern matching. Eliza shows, if nothing else, how easy it is to create and maintain the illusion of understanding, Weizenbaum wrote. He believed that once the program's mechanisms were revealed, the magic would crumble away. But Merchant says that Weizenbaum was appalled by the way users thought emotional intimacy with the bot, especially given how basic the technology was. Even after being told that the program was rudimentary, users continued to attribute understanding, empathy, and intention to Eliza. The response revealed an unsettling insight. Weizenbaum recognized that our desire to form relationships and the ease with which a computer program could be built and sold to prey upon that desire would leave people vulnerable to mass exploitation at the hands of whoever owned and operated the computer system, Merchant says. Luke Fernandez, an associate professor at Weber State University's School of Computing, similarly points out that Weizenbaum saw humans' power of projection as a potential risk factor in the evolving relationship between humans and machines. Weizenbaum dismissed the idea that there was anything inevitable about where technology might take us, or that agency resided in technology itself, Fernandez said. He worried that if humans placed too much stock in machines, we might jeopardize our accountability to each other. Weizenbaum strongly believed that human judgment and reasoning carried a moral responsibility, which shaped his understanding of technology and AI. Forced to flee Nazi Germany as a young teen, Weizenbaum saw firsthand how the Nazis' genocidal agenda had been aided by the scores of everyday people who looked the other way. He also recognized the powerful impact of the Nazis' anti-Semitic propaganda, which dehumanized Jewish families like his in service of the Nazis' eugenic effort to engineer a so-called perfect race. This campaign of dehumanization sowed complacency in the general public. Given his background, Weizenbaum was especially troubled by the dehumanizing language some of his peers used when comparing human reasoning with the possibilities of AI. He bristled at MIT researcher Marvin Minsky's description of human beings as meat machines and chafed at leading technologists' implications that future robots could present, quote, a correction and improvement on nature. Weizenbaum emphasized that this line of thinking had fueled some of the greatest atrocities in history. In the Nazi era, Jews were portrayed as vermin, a metaphor that legitimized mass murder, Weizenbaum told German journalist Bernhard Porksen in 1998. Today, the idea that man is merely an information processing machine that can be replaced by a robot is gaining substance and power. Weizenbaum warned that the immense power of an inhumane image of man can spread like a virus in a society, and that humanity must fiercely guard against it. Though Weizenbaum was never dismissive of the future capabilities of technology like AI, the potential power of machines was never his chief concern. Instead, he feared that people's projections onto these machines would hamper their better judgment. From the 1970s through the early 2000s, he was an advocate for technology ethics, urging scientists to confront the social consequences of their work. The risk he foresaw was not that technologies like AI would evolve into civilization-destroying monsters, but that society would look upon them as false idols. The real threat to humanity came from within, he believed. Technology simply gave it an outlet. Weizenbaum repeatedly insisted to his friends, "I'm not an AI critic, I'm a critic of society." Joseph Bennington Castro answers the question, why do we roll out the red carpet? It's been a symbol of power and prestige across centuries. The earliest recorded reference to the red carpet comes from the play Agamemnon, written by the Greek dramatist Aeschylus in the 5th century BC. In this story, the eponymous king returns home from the Trojan War and is greeted with a crimson pathway rolled out to honor his victories. This wasn't an actual custom during Aeschylus' time, however, and the playwright was possibly inspired by Near Eastern traditions. In the play, Agamemnon notes the unusual act and hesitates to tread on the carpet, fearing it might anger the gods. Red was a divine color reserved for deities in ancient Greece. Some historians contend Agamemnon's carpet was actually purple, a color long associated with royalty because of its exclusivity and rarity. But purple and red hues can look similar, and the shade of purple reserved for royalty gradually took on a redder cast over time. Another naturally rare color, red also symbolized rank and prestige. Paintings of deities, saints, and royalty from the Renaissance frequently feature red Ottoman carpets and rugs. Harvested from the cochineal scale insect, scarlet dyes were especially prized given their difficulty to produce. The Aztecs and Mayans used cochineal or carmine dye in their textiles for the elite. Following Spain's colonization of Mesoamerica, those dyes became a lucrative export by the 17th century. In the United States, the first well-known use of a red carpet occurred in 1821, when a crimson walkway was laid out for President James Monroe in Georgetown, South Carolina. The taste for red carpets grew in the following decades, helped by a significant decrease in the cost of cochineal dye. By the mid-19th century, synthetic dyes and automated carpet weaving made red carpets even more accessible. Despite this, red carpets maintained an association with power and prestige. In 1902, the New York Central Railroad ushered wealthy travelers onto their new 20th century limited train with the first official red carpet treatment. Hollywood rolled out its first red carpet in 1922 at the Egyptian Theater premiere of Robin Hood, starting a tradition. The Academy Awards, which began in 1929, didn't adopt the red carpet tradition until 1961. Television coverage of red carpet arrivals started in 1964, but viewers had to wait until 1966 to see the spectacle broadcast in full color. Since the early 2000s, the show has used an exclusive burgundy-like shade for its carpet called Academy Red. Hollywood stars started showing their personal fashion taste on the red carpet in the 1970s. Its reputation as a runway was cemented after the 1994 Golden Globes, when pre-show host Joan Rivers famously asked attendees, "Who are you wearing?" Today, the red carpet is a mainstay of celebrity happenings, such as award ceremonies, fundraising events like the Met Gala, and the White House Correspondents' Dinner. The dancer who became World War I's most notorious spy is the title of our next article written by Evan Andrews. Mata Hari spent much of her career claiming that she was raised as an Indian temple dancer. In reality, however, she was born Margaritha Zell on August 7, 1876, and grew up the daughter of a haberdasher in the Dutch town of Leeuwarden. Desperate for adventure, at age 18, she answered a newspaper ad and wed a much older army captain named Rudolph McLeod. His military career later took the couple to Indonesia, where they had two children. But their marriage was plagued by infidelity and domestic violence. Following the death of their young son, they moved back to Europe and divorced. The 27-year-old Margarita was left impoverished. In 1903, after losing custody of her daughter, she moved to Paris and looked to start over. "I wanted to live like a colorful butterfly in the sun," she later said. It was in the City of Lights that Margarita Zell reinvented herself as an artist. Drawing on her experiences in the Dutch East Indies, she developed a Hindu dance act and began performing under the name Lady Grisha McCloy. As part of each routine, she would cast off a series of colorful robes and veils until she was left nearly nude. "I never could dance well," she later admitted. "People came to see me because I was the first who dared to show myself naked to the public." To add to her mystique, Margarita adopted the stage name Mata Hari, a Malay phrase meaning eye of the day. Audiences were entranced by Mata Hari's claims that her rhythmic, undulating movements were part of an ancient temple rite from the Orient, and her shows quickly became a sensation. Mata Hari personifies all the poetry of India, one reviewer wrote. Its mysticism, its voluptuousness, its languor, its hypnotizing charm. Declared a star of dance in 1908, the olive-skinned beauty spent the next several years traveling Europe and performing before sold-out crowds. She also began affairs with a series of military officers and wealthy aristocrats, many of whom showered her with gifts and cash. "Tonight I dine with Count A and tomorrow with Duke B," she once quipped. "If I don't have to dance, I make a trip with Marquis C. I avoid serious liaisons." By 1914, however, Mata Hari's dalliances with rich men had become a matter of financial survival. She was now nearly 40, and she had watched her dancing career slowly stagnate. Her problems only mounted with the outbreak of World War I. She was in Berlin at the time, and when she tried to travel to France, the Germans confiscated her luggage and bank accounts. She was forced to return to her neutral homeland of Holland, where she resumed an old affair with a wealthy Dutch baron. The details of Mata Hari's espionage career became sketchy, but it seems to have begun in the fall of 1950, when she was approached by Karl Kromer, the honorary German consul in Amsterdam. Kromer evidently considered her high-class contacts and neutral Dutch citizenship a valuable asset, so he offered her 20,000 francs to become a spy for the Kaiser. The cash-strapped dancer accepted the money. She later claimed she considered it payback for the assets seized from her a year earlier. But whether she actually took part in espionage is unclear. Whatever the case, the 39-year-old was assigned a German code name, H21. Over the next several months, Mata Hari continued traveling through Europe and carrying out flings with military officers and politicians. Her constant movements, not to mention her presence in Germany at the beginning of the war, had soon attracted the attention of British intelligence, which suspected her of being an enemy agent. After questioning Mata Hari when she passed through England, the British cautioned their French allies to watch her closely. "Although she was thoroughly searched and nothing incriminating found," a report read, "she is regarded by police and military to be not above suspicion, and her subsequent movements should be watched." Mata Hari only sank deeper into wartime intrigue in 1916. That summer, a French intelligence operator named Georges Ladoux approached her in Paris with yet another lucrative espionage offer, this time to spy for France. Ladoux was well aware of Britain's suspicions that she was a German agent, but he seems to have considered the recruitment a means of either entrapping her or turning her to his side. By then, Mata Hari had begun a passionate romance with Vladimir de Maslov, a 21-year-old Russian army captain. Anxious to make money to start a new life with him, she accepted Ladeau's deal and announced her intentions to seduce military secrets out of high-ranking Germans. Following an abortive attempt to travel to Belgium in November of 1916, Mata Hari ended up in neutral Spain, where she bedded a German major named Arnold Kahl. Just what transpired between the two is the subject of much debate. The dancer evidently made a bumbling attempt to glean information from Cal, but she may have also offered him her services as a spy. In either case, by the time she returned to Paris, a French wireless station at the Eiffel Tower had intercepted coded messages that Cal sent to Berlin. Each of the communiques referred to Agent H-21, whom the French quickly identified as Mata Hari. Kahl's message may have been a calculated ploy to expose her. He allegedly sent the telegrams in an old code that the Germans knew the Allies had cracked. But they were all the evidence Ladue needed. On February 13, 1917, Mata Hari was arrested, charged with espionage, and confined to Paris's infamous Saint-Lazare prison. When not languishing in her damp, lice-ridden cell, the dancer spent the next several months under interrogation. While she spoke frankly about her promiscuous lifestyle, she was adamant that she had never committed espionage for any country other than France. "A courtesan, I admit it," she said. "A spy, never." When questioned about Calais's messages, she came clean about accepting money from the Germans, but denied passing them any secrets. "I never considered myself a German agent with a number," she pleaded, "because I never did anything for them." Mata Hari's espionage trial commenced on July 24, 1917. Despite a lack of evidence about the secret she might have passed to the Germans, the prosecution blamed her for the deaths of thousands of Allied soldiers and pointed to her numerous affairs as proof that she had been gathering intelligence. "The evil that this woman has done is unbelievable," prosecutor André Mornay concluded in his final statement. "This is perhaps the greatest woman spy of the century." In the end, it took a military tribunal less than an hour to find her guilty and sentenced her to death. The question of Mata Hari's guilt continues to fascinate historians to this day. The documents from her trial were sealed for several decades, but many of the researchers who've since studied them have concluded that the case against her was flimsy. Most of the prosecution's evidence was circumstantial, and her defense attorney was prevented from introducing witnesses that might have backed up her claims. While many scholars remain convinced that Mata Hari was indeed a spy, others contend that she was scapegoated or even framed in order to raise French morale during one of the darkest periods of the war. Nevertheless, the true extent of her espionage may never be known for certain. Whether guilty or innocent, at dawn on October 15, 1917, Mata Hari was driven to a field on the outskirts of Paris. After refusing a blindfold, she was placed against a wooden stake and executed by a firing squad of 12 French soldiers. Ever the performer, she supposedly blew a kiss to the troops moments before the fatal shots rang out. And now to end on something a little quirkier is a little article from the National Geographic's book, The Uncommon History of Common Things, by Bethane Patrick and John Thompson. This is the history of a napkin in your lap. Keep crumbs and food off your lap, catches condensation drips from glass, handy for wiping your mouth. The humble table napkin has a surprisingly long and varied history. The Spartans used lumps of dough called apomagdali, cut, rolled, and kneaded at table to wipe their hands. The ancient Romans used lengths of cloth called mappa at the edges of eating couches to protect the furnishings. In the early Middle Ages, people tended to wipe their hands and mouth with the tablecloth, so the French began putting smaller cloths on top of the tablecloth for guests to use, and so that the large tablecloth wouldn't have to be changed so frequently. By the Renaissance, the standard large napkin for table use was still extremely large, meant for people who ate mostly with knife and fingers. When forks became common during the 17th and 18th centuries, people began to value neatness in dining so greatly that they often didn't use a napkin at all, or if they did, tried to keep it spotless. Eventually, 30-inch by 36-inch became the standard. As dining became more formalized, so did napkin rules. French etiquette guides called it ungentlemanly to use a napkin for wiping the face or scraping the teeth, and a more vulgar error to wipe one's nose with it, and dictated that diners should not unfold their own napkin until the person of highest rank had. Paper napkins originating in medieval China arrived in the West in the early 20th century. And a quick reminder that coming up at 4 p.m. is Audio Journal's Backyard Bookshelf. At 5 p.m., Audio Journal Sports Page, followed by 6 p.m., Science Journal. At 7 p.m., reading of the Telegram and Gazette. At 8 p.m., USA Today. At 9, the Boston Globe. And then at 10 p.m., Backyard Bookshelves Archives, following at 11 p.m. with the same, Backyard Bookshelf Archives. You've been listening to All Things History, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. This is Tricia Droney, and if you're a history buff, please know we'd love to hear your thoughts and ideas on an interesting topic for us to investigate. Thanks so much for listening this afternoon.
Audio Journal, the radio reading service of Central Massachusetts, serving visually and print-impaired listeners since 1987. Audio Journal is a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
This is BirdNet. Molly Adams founded the Feminist Bird Club to try to make birding safer and more inclusive.
Birders who are Black, visibly disabled, and queer are going to face challenges while birding that cisgender, able-bodied white people do not, and our goal is to reduce these obstacles.
Along with co-author Sydney Golden Anderson, Molly wrote a book titled Birding for a Better World that welcomes newcomers to birding and offers ways to make events more inclusive and accessible.
We hope that this book encourages organizers to consider what needs they might not already be meeting and find ways to accommodate them. Throughout the book, you'll see a lot of suggestions from other birding organizations and ways that organizers can look to their own members and other groups in their community.
The book also debunks some myths that can scare people away from birding, Sydney says.
Birding does not necessarily mean bird walk. In fact, you don't have to walk at all while birding. Birding is for all people of all ages and abilities. You don't have to have fancy equipment to begin birding. And yes, you're a birder, even if you're a beginner.
What's more, Sydney says that birding can help improve our world.
Birding with mindfulness can be a profoundly healing practice that can help one redevelop a sense of interconnectivity with nature. How to just be there and coexist and do so in a way that's sustainable and gentle and careful and reciprocal.
Learn more about the book on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Jonice Franklin.
When my dad started to lose his vision, we were worried. Sure, his doctor gave me and my mom some handouts, and I did my fair share of research. But we had no idea how much of a challenge vision loss would be or how it would impact his quality of life. That's why I was so glad we discovered Mass Commission for the Blind. They work with my dad, and they will work with you and your loved one as well to develop future plans and new skills and assistive technology. They even helped Dad get access to talking books and newspapers. He was so excited.
If your loved one is blind or visually impaired, find out if they are eligible to register for services. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB. That's 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.